Is your life joyful? And do you think everyone has a right to joy?
How do we keep joy alive in the midst of so much sorrow in the world? Can we practice it?
And what do we mean by joy as resistance?
I'm David Denny.
I'm Tessa Bilecki.
And this is Fire and Light.
Conversations about life, love, and soul. Welcome back, everyone. It's the month of May. Spring is in full force. Life bursting everywhere, joy bursting everywhere. Passover has just ended. We're still in the Easter season for Christians. We have 50 days of Easter that last until Pentecost, which is May 19th. And all of that seems such an appropriate season for talking about joy, about our right to joy, and about joy as resistance. Let's begin with a poem. Dave, would you read us a poem by Mario Benedetti? And who is he?
Well, he was Italian background, but he spent time in Uruguay and in Madrid. And this poem is attributed to him. It's called Right to Joy. Of course, we're not a funeral procession, despite the tears we've swallowed. We are filled with joy of building what is new and enjoy the day, the night, and even our tiredness and catch the laughter in the high wind. We use our right to joy to find love in the far-off land and feel ourselves blessed to have found a companion to share bread, pain, and bed. Although we were born to be happy, we see ourselves surrounded by sorrows and bothers, by deaths and forced hidings, fleeing like fugitives. We see how wrinkles begin to appear on our foreheads, and we become serious. But always, forever, laughter dogs us, tied to our heels. And we know how to enjoy a good laugh and be happy in the deepest, most oppressive night, because we are built of a great hope, of a great optimism that takes hold of us and victory grabs us by the collar, ringing its bell louder each time. And we know nothing can happen that will stop us, because we are seed and habitat of an intimate smile that will soon explode in the faces of everyone.
I love this poem. Now, what strikes you about it?
Well, I just underlined a couple of words that strike me. Building, we're filled with joy of building something new. We're so aware of so many things being torn down, being destroyed. And to be building something new brings tremendous joy. So I love that emphasis on construction. Also sharing, joy, finding love in a far-off land and sharing bread. The word companion means sharing bread. And I just, the emphasis on friendship and sharing. Happy in the night. That's like classic St. John of the Cross. And finally, I love the phrase, intimate smile.
Yeah, I was going to say that
yeah,
too.
I remember reading once how if you want to know what the universe is all about, look at a mom smiling at her newborn child. That's not just anthropology, that's reality. And that's the bedrock of truth. So I love that.
Beautiful. There is an awful lot of wisdom going around right now about joy. That's partly why we wanted to do our podcast this month on this theme. A lot of people are talking about joy. And what are we hearing about joy?
Well, for example, we used to know, he recently died, a Zen Roshi named Bernie Glassman, who said, you know, we don't have a moment to lose on non-joy.
Yeah.
Just a nice succinct statement. Why be non-joyful? Then there's a novelist I love, Barbara Kingsolver, who says, everywhere you look, joyful noise is clanging to drown out quiet desperation. And you know, that quiet desperation, yeah, that comes from Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. And he said, most of us live lives of quiet desperation. So she's countering Thoreau there. And I like that.
Yeah, that there's more joy than quiet desperation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then finally, this is a really power-packed quote from a guy named Jack Gilbert, about whom I know nothing. He said, we must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of the world.
Yeah. Now, what I love about these particular bits of wisdom is the juxtaposition in each one. So Bernie Glassman, Zen Roshi, is talking about non-joy and joy. Barbara Kingsolver talks about desperation contrasted with joy. And I especially love this Jack Gilbert, the ruthless furnace of the world. Now, certainly today we are experiencing the ruthless furnace of the world, which he juxtaposes with gladness. And that makes me think of another poem. In this poem, the author describes the world as the ragged world. And the poem ends with our need to make a patchwork quilt, mm-hmm, out of the rags of the world, out of the raggedness of the world. So this amazing both sides of human experience. I think there's a terrible tendency among people to think that joy is something that happens outside of us. It, mm-hmm, depends on outside circumstances. Mm. What do you have to say about,
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's the idea of an extrinsic way of living. You know, you're always reacting to what's happening outside you. I remember our friend Brother David said that gratitude, gratefulness, doesn't just happen when something lovely happens to you and say, oh, thanks. But it's a radical delight in being alive. And you're thankful for that. And I think the same thing goes for joy, that it can be a radical bedrock and something you actually practice, something that, you know, like exercising a muscle.
Yeah, you have to make an effort. It isn't something that's just floating around out there.
Yeah.
And maybe you get it and maybe you don't. We have to make an effort.
Yeah.
How about your friend Wendell Berry?
Yeah, the great novelist and poet and essayist Wendell Berry. And farmer, that's right. He has a great statement in something he wrote called The Manifesto, Mad Farmer's Liberation Front. He says, so friends, every day do something that won't compute. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Ask the questions that have no answers. Put your faith in 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Laugh. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. Practice resurrection.
I love his emphasis on, you know what the world is like.
Mm-hmm.
You know it's a ruthless furnace.
Mm-hmm.
You have considered this fact and all the brutal facts,
mm-hmm,
and yet you choose to be joyful and to practice resurrection. This reminds me of Joseph Campbell, again, emphasizing joy as an active effort. Joseph Campbell is the one who did all the research on the heroes' myths around the globe. And he said, find a place where there's joy, and the joy will burn out your pain. And again, active effort. Find a place where there's joy. He's not only talking about a physical place, but where is it in life that you find joy? Seek that out. Go there. Be there.
Beautiful. There was, I think too often of like people in the civil rights movement and somebody like the visionary Sojourner Truth. She said, life is a hard battle anyway. If we laugh and sing a little as we fight the good fight of freedom, It makes it all go easier. I will not allow my life's light to be determined by the darkness around me.
Yeah, and I love this too. Again, we have juxtapositions. So she's talking about the battle, the fight, the darkness. In contrast, what does she choose to do? She chooses to laugh. She chooses to sing. She chooses to let her light shine as opposed to wallowing in the darkness. And this reminds me of, I think we need to talk about the relationship between joy and sorrow, because I think there's a tendency to separate them, to separate the light from the darkness, the furnace of the world from our gladness. And I was very moved by a Black poet and activist whose name is Ross Gay. He wrote a book called Inciting Joy. I'm going to be quoting a lot of Black activists because I'm fascinated that a lot of the wisdom that we're learning that's being talked about today about the importance of joy is coming from a people of color who have especially suffered oppression and persecutions. The most important teaching is what he says about the importance of recognizing that joy and sorrow are entangled. And when we talk about joy, we have the terrible temptation to think that it means without pain or without sorrow, as if we could, live without heartbreak and sorrow. Let me quote him directly here because it's got this bite and a part of what I love about him. He says, which I'm pretty sure you only get to do, that is no sorrow or heartbreak, if you have no relationships, love nothing, are a sociopath, and maybe if you're enlightened. And then he says, I don't know about you, but I didn't check any of these boxes. I can't check any of these boxes. So that we cannot separate the joy from the pain. And he says, what if they're all tangled up together? Even more, he goes on to say, what if the joy is not only mixed up with the sorrow, but the joy is what emerges when we take care of each other through our pain, through our sorrow? He even goes so far as to define joy as holding each other through sorrow. So it's that connection with others that's so important. And we're going to keep talking about that connection between joy and our relationship with others.
I remember reading in the poet Khalil Gibran something really powerful on that notion that there's a non-duality about joy and sorrow. And he said, some of you say joy is greater than sorrow. And others say, nay, sorrow is greater. But I say unto you, they are inseparable. Together they come. And when one sits alone with you at your board, your table, remember that the other is asleep on your bed.
We're quoting a lot of people here. We're reading a lot of poetic passages. And I think there's a danger of thinking that all of this is just unrealistic poetry, or it's just theory, or it's just cheap talk. So I think it's very important for us, Dave, to give some concrete examples of people that we either know personally or we know about who have been through enormous sorrow, enormous pain, and have come out the other side full of joy. I want to talk about a friend of mine. Let's just call him Joe to kind of protect him. He has an autoimmune disease which has left him both trembling and crippled, and he will eventually freeze up and become paralyzed. He has great difficulty eating, walking, moving at all. Here's what he wrote me recently. He said, I just had a visit with him, and I was reminding him of this that he wrote to me around the time that he was diagnosed with this disease. He said, the elements of life are all interwoven. Here we have this, again, this beautiful non-duality, blue sky and disappointments, heartbreak and breakfast. That's kind of my favorite combination. The infinity of space and human trafficking, laughter and the depredations of slugs. This is a good one because he was a professional gardener. And then a flower and the wind that shreds it, pain and poetry. And as we went out hiking recently, he said, you know, I don't feel sorry for myself. This disease that I have, this disease is a facet of the diamond that is my life. It is not my life. It is a facet of my life, a facet of the diamond of my life. And he was enormously full of joy in the midst of this suffering.
I also think about Petru Dumitriu. I think he was a Romanian. He was a novelist, lived through World War II, saw some horrible things during the war.
And yet, under the communist regime.
Yep, had every reason to despair. And he said, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. Nothing seems capable of overcoming the weight of evil in this world. And then I walk out in the morning and I see little kittens rolling around in the grass. And I have to say, that's beautiful. That's wonderful. And I'm full of joy. And he came to the conclusion that the quantity of evil, the weight of that quantity, is outweighed by the quality of joy and of prayer in this world.
Yeah.
He couldn't explain it. He just said, that's my experience.
Yeah. Very powerful witness, like the witness of Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama. Well, how would you describe them?
Well, in 2015, the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu met in Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile in northern India. And
it was his 80th birthday, right?
Yep.
The Dalai Lama's
80th
birthday.
80th birthday. So they knew neither of them had much time left. And Desmond Tutu had struggled with cancer. So these two, who had undergone some of the most terrible persecutions, really, of the 20th century, got to know each other over the years, and then they had this, what turned out to be a final visit with each other.
Now, what have they been through for those maybe younger people who are listening who may not know what Desmond Tutu suffered and what the Dalai Lama suffered?
Well, in the late 1950s, the Chinese drove the Dalai Lama out of Tibet. They felt that Buddhism was oppressive and that the new communist regime would liberate people from the oppression of religion. So he then had to go into exile, and many people were killed at that time.
Yeah, monasteries were closed. Many people were sent into forced labor.
And then Desmond Tutu was the Anglican Archbishop in South Africa
yeah,
during the time of apartheid, when the white people basically separate, you know, total segregation from the blacks and extreme oppression. And that, of course, was the time when then eventually Nelson Mandela was released from prison and began to the transformation that led to, you know, the downfall of apartheid. And Tutu was there through all that.
Okay, so then these two giants of our age came together for the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. And what happened when these two men of great suffering came together? What happened?
The first thing I think most people notice is they just kept laughing.
Yeah.
And they kept touching each other. That were the two things that were very moving to me.
And they were just full of joy, a concrete example of joy as the end result of tremendous suffering. And we're going to come back to them as a witness in a minute.
Tell me more about you. I hear you talking about joy as resistance. What do you mean by that?
I keep finding this phrase, joy as resistance, and it crops up again and again. I keep finding it among Black activist women. They are emphasizing the fact that joy is an act of resistance. And I just want to tell you a little bit about three people. The first is the theologian Barbara Holmes, and she has written a book about the contemplative life of Black people beginning in the time of slavery. The title of her book is Joy Unspeakable. And she opens with this poem, "Joy unspeakable erupts when you least expect it, when the burden is greatest, when the hope is gone, after bullets fly. It rises on the crest of impossibility and sways to the rhythm of steadfast hearts and celebrates what we cannot see." And she uses the phrase joy as resistance, so that as a result of all this suffering, particularly during slavery, Black people learned how to celebrate with joy. They celebrated with joy. And her description, she's quoting someone else, who describes joy not as happiness, which can be a passing emotion, but joy, she says, is the deep-seated conviction that one's life makes sense. So she's the first person I read. I highly recommend this book, a very painful read, but very worthwhile. Part of the value of that book is how she talks about how contemplation, the contemplative experience, does not need to be quiet or silence. That's all I'll say about it, because another time we might talk more about it. Okay, the original phrase, joy is an act of resistance, was coined by another woman, a Black poet and memoirist, Toy Derricotti, and at the beginning of a strange little poem about her fish, her pet fish in a bowl, which she wrote in 2008, she wrote, "Joy is an act of resistance." All right. She's also an activist. Okay. Now then, this is picked up by a third reference for me is another Black theologian, she's a minister, another activist. Her name is Austin Channing Brown. And she writes about the joy that her human dignity demands. She says, "My dignity demands it." And here she is out fighting for justice. And she says, we don't just pursue racial justice when we're out there organizing or voting or protesting or speech making or volunteering or working. She says, we are also pursuing justice when we are joyful. I found this just an incredibly freeing statement. Her book is called I'm Still Here, Black Dignity in a World Made for Whiteness. And she says when she came across that quote from Derricotti about joy as resistance, it helped her stop working herself to death, because what she was working for would not only come about through hard work, but it would come about through the celebration of joy. And I've got to read you this lengthy quote from her, because it is so juicy. It's so perfect, we've just got to have it. So here's what she said. I am opening my life for a joy as thick as my thighs. You know, only a woman's going to write this. A joy that jiggles and wiggles, a joy with some heft and tiger stripes. I want a joy as big as my belly, rolling over on top of itself with abundance. I want a joy that inhabits every curly coil on my head, that's weaved through every twist, every braid, and yes, every wig. I want a joy as full as my lips, as wide as my nose, as bright as my eyes. I want a joy that tumbles out of me. So this is what we mean by joy as resistance, as witnessed to by concrete individuals alive and well in the world today, struggling, working very hard, and celebrating the joy that their dignity demands. Which leads us to our practice for this podcast day, for this month of May.
Yes. So for your practice this month, I would suggest you pick up the book called The Book of Joy, which is an account of that encounter between the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. You also may want to look at the video called Mission Joy, Finding Happiness in Troubled Times. And that is great because you get the visual
of the two men on Netflix.
That's available on Netflix, yes. And I would suggest you go to missionjoy.org because there's a whole movement really behind the encounter between Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. And there's even good practical advice on that website, missionjoy.org, about practicing joy in your life.
And they recommend 4 concrete ways to practice joy.
Yeah, they have a whole section on there on what's called the science of joy and how it affects us, our whole being, physical as well as mental and emotional. And they say, 1, be grateful, practice gratitude, practice connecting with other people. So important in an isolated world. They suggest reframing, they call it, which means stand back and think, could there be, for example, a silver lining in this catastrophe? What door might open as this painful hurdle is crossed? So those are some really
excellent. And the 4th thing, I think, is to practice kindness.
Exactly.
So that all of these practices issue in the experience of joy.
Yeah.
I think all of this is what Wendell Berry meant when he said, practice resurrection, or what Benedetti means when he says that we need to use our right to joy. And those other great quotes that you read, they really were all about practice.
Gilbert, for example, Jack Gilbert said, risk delight.
Risk it. So, yeah, which means you have to act.
Yeah, or be stubborn about it. Don't slide, into despair or into acquiescence. Accept gladness. I thought that was a nice way to put it. Some of us have trouble receiving, like receiving a gift. Well, just try to learn how to accept gladness, not feel like, well, in a painful world, I shouldn't be glad. It is a right. And it is part of, I love how one poet you just described called it part of human dignity.
Yeah.
Don't let anybody take your human dignity because then, they've won.
And that's really what Sojourner Truth was saying. Mm-hmm. She was not going to allow anyone to rob her of her dignity.
Right.
So she would laugh, she would sing again, actions.
Yeah.
And maybe she didn't feel the joy when she started to sing, but then that would evoke the experience of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, let's go back to Joseph Campbell, who said that we need to find the places that bring us joy, and that's where we need to go because.
Well, the joy is an act of resistance, and it can burn out all that pain.
And we have a right to it, and our dignity demands it. So that is our practice, to practice resurrection, practice joy. If you need more inspiration, read the Book of Joy, watch the film Mission to Joy, go on that website. And now it's time for our meditation, which is by George Bernard Shaw. And It's about what he describes as the true joy in life. And I love, we've been meditating on this passage from Shaw for decades, Dave. It's one of our favorite passages. He says that we have to stop being selfish little clods. I love this. Selfish little clods of grievances, complaining about the world and how it won't devote itself to making me happy, as if, yes, my dignity demands that I be joyful, but it isn't the responsibility of the world to give it to me. It's my responsibility. So in this passage, Shaw is saying we need to change our mindset. Instead of being selfish little clods, we have to become a force of nature and give ourselves to the whole community. Now, here's that connectedness that the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu's movement is telling us we need to make. We need to pass on our torch for the sake of others. And this is the true joy in life. This is what brings us joy. So set us up, Dave, for this meditation now.
Take a few deep breaths. And focus on what it feels like to really be able to breathe. And allow all kinds of thoughts, good thoughts, bad thoughts, just allow them to drift past. And create that space between thoughts where you feel safe and where anxieties flee to the periphery.
This is the true joy in life. Being used for a purpose you recognize as a mighty one.
Being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy.
My life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it what I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die. For the harder I work, the more I live.
I rejoice in life for its own sake.
Life is no brief candle to me. It's a sort of splendid torch, which I have got hold of for the moment.
And I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations.
This is the true joy in life.
This is the true joy in life.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for listening.
Share this podcast with your friends.
Explore our themes more deeply on our websites, tessabalecki.com
and sandandsky.org.
And if you like what you see, press that donation button.
You've been listening to Fire and Light.
Conversations about life, love, and soul.
The background music for Fire and Light is The Day We Met, composed and performed by Ricky Zhao.
Fire and Light's theme music is Dreamcatcher, composed and performed by Chris Martin and Jeff Harvey at Purple Planet Music.
Fire and Light is recorded in Tucson, Arizona, editing by David Levin.